Now a panel on whether or not the Bush administration bears any responsibility for the attacks of 9/11. Featuring David Ray Griffin, author of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, Ray McGovern, CIA veteran and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and more. This event, hosted by Berkeley, California-based Pacifica radio station, KPFA, is just over 2 hours.
I'd like to bring out our host for this evening's program. He's a 27-year veteran intelligence analyst and a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. This organization's first effort was a same-day critique of Secretary of State Colin Powell's address to the United Nations on February 5, 2003. He brought the CIA's daily briefings to 7 different presidents. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Ray McGovern.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much. Please. Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me all right? You can. Louder. Okay. Maybe I'll lift it up a little bit. How about that? It's better. Okay. Well, thanks for being here. This is very encouraging. Very, very encouraging indeed. I was thinking of what I might say as an intelligence professional, and I guess I would start with how we evaluate information. It has a lot to do with the sources, whether they have access to grind, whether they have a specific agenda, whether their name is Chalabi. Now, comparisons are invidious, but when you compare the folks who will be addressing you this evening with folks like Dick Cheney and others, they're really invidious, and I think that we don't want to damn with faint praise by saying we've got a top-notch group of professionals here to share their wisdom with you. I think it would be good to set the stage by recalling to mind what happened after 9/11, amid the initial attempts to do the sensible thing, and that is get an investigation of what happened. You may recall that Dick Cheney was dead set against it. He said, hey, there's a war going on. The last thing we need to do is expend our energies to investigating these things. And he prevailed for several months. And finally, the heat became a little too hot, and he acquiesced in letting an investigation go forward. But he picked his godson, a fellow named Porter Goss, to lead the investigation. With the sleepy Bob Graham thinking about running for president, sort of tagging along behind. First thing that happened was they spent about 4 or 5 months looking for an executive director. You know, they didn't seem to be really in a lot of hurry to get this job done. And then they finally found one, and who did it turn out to be? Well, they did turn out to have a fairly good one for the beginning, Eleanor Hill, who had been the Inspector General at the Pentagon. And she started off, and the first thing that happened then was that there was a leak of an NSA intercept talking about sensitive matters. And immediately, Dick Cheney called up his godson, Porter Goss, and said, this can't be. We have to investigate this. I want you to call Ashcroft and have him sic the FBI on these congressmen and senators in this joint commission of inquiry and find out who leaked that. And so for the first time in my 27 years of experience, one branch of government, the executive, was going to be sending the FBI to put the polygraph tests and everything else on members of Congress, Senate, and representatives. And they did. And Porter Goss acquiesced in that, and so did Bob Graham, until finally Daschle said, gee, you know, I think we have our own... Yeah, we have our own investigatory commission that does this kind of thing in the Congress, so maybe we ought not to allow this. And only then did it stop. So that was the way this thing got going, you know, off to a great start. At the end, I remember, at the end, when the first formal open meeting in September of 2002 happened, I watched it on TV, and I remember Eleanor Hill, to her credit, standing up before everyone and saying, now, I want to just to make things abundantly clear here that we have not have been able to have a full report. Our negotiations with the White House went into the wee hours of the morning this morning, and we failed. And so the White House has demanded, and we have acquiesced, in omitting from this transcript anything having to do with what the President was told about the impending catastrophe. Even if it's open media, even if it's available publicly, we are not allowed to include that in our report. And so that's how the joint inquiry, Senate and House, ended up. The families of 9/11, of course, were up in arms, and it was largely due to their pressure that another commission was appointed. And this one, of course, was to be headed up by none other than Henry Kissinger, right? Give us a break. That one fell apart when the 9/11 commissions asked him pointedly about conflicts of interest and other truth-telling things. And then we had Governor Keene, who made a virtue out of his ignorance of what goes on in Washington. He said, "This will be great. I haven't had any experience in Washington, and I'll come down and I'll do this." And the reporter said, "Well, don't you think that you're going to have to come stay down here for a while?" He said, "Oh, no. I'm president of Drew University. I'll come down once a week, and I'll see what I can do." Later, he complained that if he came down once a week, it took him half the day to get access to his notes in the White House, and then another half the day to leave his notes at the White House. And he said, "You know, it's very, very difficult to do this, because they're all secret, and, you know, they make a lot of secrets out of these things." And all he had to do, folks, was to say, "Look, I want a security officer in my library up there at Drew University 24 hours. I want to be able to take notes with me, and I want to be able to study this thing at my leisure." It was really amazing how Keene did this kind of thing. Hamilton, well, suffice it to say, Hamilton, those of you with a little gray in your hair, remember his performance as the fixer for the Iran-Contra affair. It was he who pretty much made sure that nobody got hurt, nobody got really, really bloodied in that, even though it was a very bloody affair. Now, the composition of the commission was really something to behold. Every one of them looked just like me, except one token woman. Otherwise, they all looked just like me. They were all either lawyers or politicians, and some of them were actually both. Not that I have anything against lawyers or politicians, but it didn't seem to be quite representative of the folks who died on 9/11. And I resented that then, and I resent it now. And when they picked their executive director, of course it was Philip Zelikow, not at all a disinterested party. So it's small wonder that things got missed in this investigation. I had occasion last week to have 10 minutes with former Secretary of Transportation Norm Mineta. He happened to be speaking at a place where I was speaking, at Georgetown University. And when he finished, I said to myself, "You know, I really ought to go down and see if I can intercept him on the way out and ask him some questions." And then, well, maybe I better not. You know, then I thought, you know, Ann Wright wouldn't hesitate, you know. Cindy Sheehan wouldn't hesitate. Medea Benjamin would hesitate. What kind of wuss are you, McGovern? And so I did. And I said, politicians are really interesting. He didn't know me from Adam. But it was just one-on-one. He was with an escort, a Collegian person, and I went up and said, "I'm Ray McGovern." "Oh, Ray, so good to see you." I said, "Secretary Mineta, you could really help us here by explaining why it was that your testimony was sort of dropped out of the final report, you know? And besides, who is that young man, you know? That young man that came in and talked about the plane only being out 50 miles, 30 miles. It was really bizarre with the vice president there. How do you figure that?" Well, he diverted the conversation to Pennsylvania, you know, and the plane that went down there. I said, no, this is about 77, the one who went to the Pentagon. He just didn't seem to be able to get it. I said, "Who is the young man?" He said, "Beats, I don't know, you know, I don't know who the young man." Well, wouldn't it be interesting to know who the young man was who came in and asked Dick Cheney, "Do the orders still stand?" And he said, "Yes." "Again, the orders still stand?" "Yes." "And last time, they're real close now, the orders still stand? Did I tell you anything different?" plane or something goes into the Pentagon. So there's lots of stuff that's been going on. Mineta was singularly unhelpful, even though he gave me 10 minutes, and we can talk more about such things with people who know much more about such things than I. It is a very, very rare privilege for me to be able to sort of stand up here in the presence of these folks who have given their life's blood to studying what's happened. And I have nothing but the highest respect for them, and I'd like to bring them on now, all four. David Ray Griffin. And Peter Dale Scott. And Kevin, and Peter Phillips. And now I would like to introduce specifically David Ray Griffin, who will be starting with his presentation.
Good evening. I want to use my time to discuss the purpose of our book. This purpose, which is twofold, is reflected in the title and the subtitle. Let me begin with the subtitle, Intellectuals Speak Out. Those of us who reject the official theory have widely been called conspiracy theorists. And of course we are. But so are defenders of the official theory. A conspiracy is simply when two or more people conspire in secret to do something illegal. The official theory says that these people were Osama bin Laden and 19 Arab Muslims. And quite a conspiracy theory this official story is. It implies that these 19 men defeated the most expensive, sophisticated defense system in history, and even in bringing down three buildings of the World Trade Center, defeated several basic laws of physics. So our views cannot be dismissed simply by pointing out that we are conspiracy theorists. There must be something else about us that makes us worthy of snide dismissal by the mainstream media. This additional something is sometimes suggested by referring to us as conspiracy theorists on the Internet. The point of that statement being that obviously we are people who can't get anything published in standard ways. But of course many of us have. Our movement has produced dozens of books. So perhaps recognizing this, they come right out and say what they have meant all along, calling us the 9/11 conspiracy nuts. This is the actual title of Alexander Coburn's article the weekend prior to the fifth anniversary of 9/11 in Counterpunch, with a briefer version in The Nation magazine. This term has also been used by other journalists. Still another journalist, perhaps intending to explain why we are nuts, says that our theories are profoundly irrational and unscientific. This is where our book comes in. These critics can, at least for readers who have not read my books, get away with calling me an irrational, unscientific nut. After all, I'm a theologian. And everyone knows that theologians base their conclusions on faith, not evidence and reason. But can these critics plausibly claim that the rest of the contributors to our volume are irrational nuts? One of these contributors is Richard Falk, emeritus professor of international law at Princeton University. Would The Nation magazine call him a nut? I would hope not, since he has long been one of their editorial advisors. Another contributor is John McMurtry, emeritus professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph and a member of the Royal Society of Canada. I suspect he knows far more about the rules of reasoning than do the columnists who call members of our movement irrational. Another contributor is Danielle Gonser, who is a senior researcher at the Institute for Strategic Studies at the University of Zurich. Still another is Ola Tunander, who has published 11 books on military strategy and geopolitics, and is research professor at the International Peace Research Institute in Oslo. Our contributors also include Stephen Jones, professor of physics at Brigham Young University. Jones and Kevin Ryan, who is with us tonight, surely know... surely know far more about scientific methods than critics who call the intellectual leaders of our movement unscientific. Our book cannot, therefore, be dismissed as the product of conspiracy theorists, if that term is being used to mean irrational, unscientific nuts. Our book also serves to overcome another caricature of the 9/11 truth movement, which is that it is made up exclusively of leftists. Stephen Jones is a Mormon, and Mormons are not generally known for their leftist political leanings. Another contributor is Karen Kwiatkowski, who is a former lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. She also has a Ph.D. from Catholic University of America and writes essays from a libertarian point of view. Another libertarian contributor is Morgan Reynolds, who was the chief economist in the Department of Labor during the first term of the Bush-Cheney administration. The fact that many true conservatives belong to the 9/11 truth movement is also illustrated by two people who endorsed our book. One of these is Catherine Austin Fitz, who was Assistant Secretary for Housing during the administration of the first President Bush. Another blurb was written by Paul Craig Roberts, who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury during the Reagan administration. So much for our book's subtitle. I turn now to the title, 9/11, An American Empire. I will introduce this topic by quoting the endorsement by Paul Craig Roberts, who wrote, "This is the most important book of our time. Distinguished national and international scientists and scholars present massive evidence that the 9/11 Commission report is a hoax and that the 9/11 terrorist attack has been manipulated to serve a hegemonic agenda in the Middle East." You might be tempted to regard Robert's statement that this is the most important book of our time as hyperbole. But let's think about this. If our position that 9/11 was an inside job is true, this means that the claim that America was attacked by Arab Muslims is a lie. It means that the so-called war on terror is a hoax because the 9/11 terrorists were within our own government. It means that not only the attack on Iraq, but also the attack on Afghanistan was completely devoid of justification. It means, therefore, that all the people in those two countries who have died as a result of our invasions, well over 100,000 people, have been killed on the basis of a lie. It means that the Bush-Cheney administration, which regularly describes the rulers of other countries as evil, is itself guilty of treason, mass murder of its own citizens, and mass murder of Afghanis and Iraqis. If 9/11 was an inside job, it means that all the post-9/11 restrictions on American freedoms and all the invasions of our privacy have been justified on the basis of a lie. If 9/11 is orchestrated by the Bush-Cheney administration and its Pentagon to expand the American empire, which was already the most extensive empire the world has ever known, as Ronald Steele observed already in 1967, and neocon Charles Krauthammer reaffirmed early in 2002, saying that we are the undisputed masters of the world, if 9/11 was orchestrated to expand this already huge empire, then we Americans need to ask ourselves if we wish to continue supporting this imperial project by continuing to spend more on military matters than do all the other countries of the world combined. So if our book, by demonstrating that the 9/11 movement is led by intellectuals who base their conclusions on strong evidence and sound reasoning, is able to convince Americans that 9/11 was indeed an inside job, orchestrated to increase military spending and give the administration a carte blanche to indulge its fantasy of having the first all-inclusive empire in history. If our book has the potential to do this, then what book could be called more important? But does our book have the potential to convince Americans of these truths? My own essay, which is a revised version of my lecture, 9/11 and the American Empire, which I gave in Madison in 2005, provides several types of evidence that 9/11 must have been an inside job. Part of this evidence is the fact that the military, in trying to explain why it failed to intercept the hijacked airliners, has now given us three different stories. When a suspect in a criminal case does this, we assume that he's lying to cover up his guilt. For example, let's say that a bank was robbed in a small town and the police suspect Charlie Smith. They come to him and say, "Charlie, where were you Saturday night?" He says, "Oh, I was at the movies." "No, Charlie, the movie theater's been closed all week." "Oh, that's right, I was with my girlfriend." "No, Charlie, we checked with her and she was home with her husband." So Charlie says, "Oh, that's right, I stayed home and read my Bible that night." They're probably not going to believe him, but we have a similar situation with the military. They first said they didn't scramble any jets until after the Pentagon was struck. That, in other words, they didn't stop the first three flights because they didn't try. Although that was probably the truth, it was an unacceptable truth. They quickly told a second story, which is that they did scramble jets, but they all got there too late because the FAA had been unaccountably slow in notifying the military about these hijackings. However, early members of the 9/11 Truth Movement did the math, and they showed that even if the FAA had been as slow as the military claimed, the military still would have had time to intercept. It still looked like a stand-down. And so, with the appearance of the 9/11 Commission report in 2004, we got a third story, according to which the FAA, after being very late in reporting the hijacking of the first airliner, did not even notify the military about the other three planes until after they had crashed. The military's new answer, therefore, is that they didn't intercept the planes because they were reading their Bibles. Because they didn't know about the hijackings. However, this new story is completely implausible for many reasons. One reason is that it contains obvious lies, a couple of which I illustrate in my chapter. A second reason is that it paints a picture of sudden FAA incompetence that day that is beyond belief. Still another problem is that if the new story is true, then the story that the military had been telling for the three previous years was false. If the military was lying then and telling a story that got them only partly off the hook, why should we believe them now when they're telling a story that gets them completely off the hook? Another reason I give for concluding that the attacks of 9/11 were an inside job is that the official account of the attack on the Pentagon is absurd. According to this account, Hani Hanjour, who could barely fly a tiny Cessna, performed a feat with a Boeing 757 that even an expert pilot probably could not have pulled off, doing an amazing 270-degree downward spiral in order to come in and hit the west wing of the Pentagon at virtually ground level, and all this without scratching the Pentagon's lawn. Another problem with this story is that if these Muslim hijackers were brilliant enough to outfox the U.S. military's defense system, they would have known that the West Wing was the worst place to strike. For one thing, it had been reinforced, so there was less damage to the Pentagon than hitting any other part of it would have caused. Even more important, the Secretary of Defense and all the top brass, whom these terrorists who hated America presumably would have wanted to kill, were all safely ensconced in the East Wing, as far away from the West Wing as possible. Why would an Al-Qaeda pilot have executed a very difficult maneuver to hit the West Wing when he could have simply crashed into the roof of the East Wing, something that perhaps even Hani Hanjour could have done? Still another problem is the fact that, as indicated by both photographs and eyewitnesses, there were no signs that the Pentagon had been struck by a large airliner. One of the eyewitnesses was Karen Kwiatkowski. In her chapter in our book, she writes, "There was a dearth of visible debris on the relatively unmarked lawn, where I stood only moments after the impact. Beyond this strange absence of airliner debris, there was no sign of the kind of damage to the Pentagon structure one would expect from the impact of a large airliner." However, probably the strongest reason to hold that 9/11 was an inside job is the fact that the official story about the World Trade Center collapse is impossible. According to this story, the collapses were caused by the impact of the planes plus the resulting fires. One reason to conclude that this is impossible is simply the fact that fire, or fire plus damage caused by anything other than preset explosives, had never before caused the total collapse of a steel-framed high-rise building, even when the fires had been much bigger and hotter and had lasted much longer. All such collapses have been produced by explosives. So the natural assumption, the scientific assumption, would be that these three collapses were also caused by explosives. Moreover, there were several features of these collapses that can be explained only through the use of powerful explosives. The chapter in our book by physicist Stephen Jones describes many such features. For one thing, under all three buildings, there was a molten metal which remained hot for many weeks after the attacks. Now, a hydrocarbon fire, an open hydrocarbon fire, can at most get to 1700 degrees Fahrenheit. Steel does not even begin to melt until 2800 degrees Fahrenheit. Furthermore, they found a piece of steel that was partially evaporated. To evaporate steel, you need a temperature of over 5100 degrees Fahrenheit. A third factor, these buildings came straight down. Now, of course, the towers began by exploding outward, but once that was over, they came straight down. Building 7 came perfectly straight down. This means that these were symmetrical collapses. For this to occur, all the steel columns had to collapse simultaneously. In World Trade Center 7, there were 81 columns. In the Twin Towers, there were 283 columns. So the official story would have you to believe that these random fires throughout the building, which were very unequal, somehow simultaneously caused all 283 columns in each of the Twin Towers to fail simultaneously. Furthermore, these buildings came down at virtually free fall speed, which means that in the case of the towers, the upper floors, as they collapsed down on the lower floors, met no resistance whatsoever. That violates one of the basic laws of physics, the law of the conservation of momentum. Furthermore, in the towers, there were horizontal ejections, pieces of aluminum and even steel thrown out 500 feet horizontally. According to the official story, the only energy was gravitational energy. Well, that's vertical energy. What explains those horizontal ejections? Furthermore, testimony of literally dozens of people on the scene, firefighters, medical workers, journalists, and so on, saying they heard many, many powerful explosions in the buildings. The official theory cannot explain a single one of these features, but these features can all be easily explained on the theory that preset explosives were used. So in spite of what the government officials and the mainstream journalists say, only the alternative conspiracy theory can be defended on scientific grounds. It is the defenders of the official theory who are being irrational and unscientific. I will conclude by emphasizing that only part of our book is devoted to showing that 9/11 must have been an inside job. Equal attention is paid to 9/11's strategic importance for the current phase of American imperialism, which Richard Falk, John McMurtry, Peter Phillips, Ola Tunander, Morgan Reynolds, and I all characterize in terms of Falk's phrase, the global domination project. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Couple of quick questions. What gets my goat is my pet goat. The notion that the President of the United States is in a position where everyone in the whole world knows where he is. He learns about the second plane hitting. The Secret Service person locally there is heard to say, we're out of here. And yet he sits around to read my pet goat. A friend of mine was the head of Ronald Reagan's White House detail in the Secret Service, and I asked him, Jerry, I said, how do you figure that? The local Secret Service fellow must have been overruled by somebody who knew the president wasn't in any danger. That's my conclusion. He says, well, no, Ray. He said, gotta be something else. He said, maybe the plane ran out of fuel or something. I said, Jerry, give me a break. He says, there's no other explanation. How do you figure that the president stayed there and read My Pet Goat for 10 or whatever it was minutes where everybody knew exactly where he was? If he wasn't thinking about himself, how about those poor kids at the school?
Thank you. This is one of the many pieces of evidence I had to excise for reasons of time. But I do think it's one of the strongest pieces of evidence that it was not only an inside job, but that the head of the Secret Service detail had to know who was in charge of the planes. Because, even if they didn't take seriously their job of protecting the president, even if they didn't worry about the kids and the teachers and the staff at the school, they themselves would have been killed if there had been a hijacked airliner bearing down on the school at that very minute. And they should have, if it was a surprise attack, they should have had every reason to believe that. Because at that time, they knew, according to the official story, that America was being attacked by terrorists going after high-value targets. There would be no target higher value than the President of the United States. And yet the Secret Service, there was one fellow, evidently, according to the local paper, who said, we're out of here, as soon as he saw the second tower hit. But if that's true, he was overridden by the head of the detail, who let Bush not only stay in the classroom, but stay at the school for another 30 minutes and even give a public statement on TV saying, hi, gang, I'm still here. You still got a chance to get me. So this is very strong evidence that this was not a surprise attack.
What's his name?
A quick follow-up question here. What's whose name? That is not known to me. Does anyone know?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that at the 9/11 commission, they asked the head of the Secret Service about this. Why did you not rush the president out of school? And they said, well, we didn't think it was necessary to run him out of the room, as if decorum was more important than saving his life. And nobody asked the obvious question, was there somewhere in between running him out of the room and leaving him there for 30 minutes, like walking him out of the room?
Yeah, on a more serious note, Secretary Mineta admitted to me that there were 6 or 7 planes that were completely unaccounted for at precisely this time. So, the riddle is really cries out for explanation. The other thing that I'd like to ask you has to do with one thing that seemed to work really well. I mean, you have to admire the detectives of the FBI that were able to retrieve the passport of Mohammed Atta from the ashes of... How do you figure that? That was really quite an amazing accomplishment, was it not?
There were so many amazing things that day that, you know, after the Pentagon was struck, everybody should have been in absolute shock, you know, the most well-protected building in the world. And these terrorists rammed into it, and yet the FBI had the presence of mind to get right over there to that Citgo gas station and confiscate the video that would have shown what it was that hit the Pentagon. So lots of amazing things going on that day.
It is now my privilege to introduce to you Kevin Ryan. Kevin worked for... Kevin worked for Underwriters Laboratories until he started asking unwelcome questions. A lot of us have had that experience, asking unwelcome questions, and a lot of us have suffered similar fate, but none more graphic than Kevin, who was ousted several days after he really questioned the government's rendition of the fall of the Twin Towers. Now, Kevin is no longer the division manager of Underwriter Labs, but he has lots to say about his impressions of what happened. Please welcome Kevin Ryan.
Thank you. Thanks for the chance to be here today, and it's an honor to be associated with such distinguished company and to speak in such a fine community as Berkeley. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I came to write a chapter in a book called 9/11 and American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. And then I'd like to spend a few minutes continuing to speak out. I'm formerly a manager at Underwriters Laboratories, otherwise known as UL. About 3 years ago, while managing UL's water testing division, I began asking questions of UL's corporate management about our company's involvement in performing fire resistance tests of steel components used in the World Trade Center buildings. I started asking these questions for several reasons. First, UL CEO had commented verbally just after 9/11 that UL had certified the steel used to build the World Trade Center towers. Secondly, it was clear to me that our government had lied about the reasons for going to war in Iraq. Thirdly, there was an alternative and apparently more probable explanation for how the World Trade Center buildings had collapsed, and there was evidence for this alternative explanation. And finally, most of the steel that would help determine what happened had been quickly recycled in an unprecedented destruction of evidence. Knowing all this, I wrote to the CEO of UL, Loring Knobloch, in late 2003, asking him to confirm his claim of fire resistance testing of the steel. Knobloch wrote back, copying several top managers at UL, and he did confirm that the World Trade Center steel was tested by UL. Note, this testing would have been done 40 years ago before any of us worked there, but it was clear that Knobloch had been given information about our company's involvement. He said, quote, "We tested the steel with all the required fireproofing on it, and it did beautifully." He also wrote, "We tested the New York City code requirements, and the steel clearly met those requirements and exceeded them." Now let me be clear, I'm not working from memory, and this is not hearsay. I do have these statements in writing, so does my attorney. UL knows this, of course, because they have at least this much writing, this much information in writing themselves. Knobloch copied his response to Tom Chapin, the chemist who managed the fire protection division at UL. Tom responded to me as well, although a little less directly. He began by making the curious point that UL does not certify structural steel, adding that UL tests steel assemblies for fire resistance. His point was that steel assemblies, or columns bolted together and covered with fireproofing, are what is actually tested. Apparently, Knobloch's statements on the subject had generated this standard corporate answer. But in this book, I liken Chapin's answer to saying, "We don't crash test the car door, we crash test the whole car." Chapin went on to clarify that UL had not tested the floor assemblies, even underlining the phrase, used to build the World Trade Center towers. By making this clarification, he was directing my attention toward the primary hypothesis for collapse at that time, the notion of floor collapse, otherwise known as the pancake theory. But his answer also implied that the CEO was right, in that UL had performed tests in support of the other half of the New York City code requirement for fire resistance, that of the steel component assemblies, or the columns. Knobloch and Chapin asked me to wait for the report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. They said UL was right in the middle of this investigation and that the answers would be found. In August of 2004, UL did perform fire resistance tests on models of World Trade Center floor assemblies as part of the NIST investigation. But surprisingly, the floor models did not fail in the tests. Despite being exposed to higher temperatures for longer periods of time than was the case on September 11th. It seemed clear to me then that those supporting the official Firebase story were going to be in trouble trying to explain this. 2 months later, in October of 2004, NIST put out what was to be their final draft report, which was already overdue. This report included the results of the UL floor model tests, along with some test results that would be even more difficult to explain. Those other test results from NIST's own metallurgy group, led by Frank Gale, showed that the steel samples selected specifically from the fire zones had seen temperatures of only about 500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is far too low to soften steel. The summary of NIST's draft report did not explain these results, however, but appeared to ignore them in favor of a shady computer model that suggested the softening of vast quantities of steel within the buildings. After seeing this draft report, I decided to write directly to Frank Gale at NIST for clarification. Although I anticipated the possibility of a negative response from UL and from NIST, I felt that the information in this report was critical to the future of all people around the world. The letter I wrote to Frank Gale was respectful and professional and contained information that should not have been a surprise to anyone. The facts that the jet fuel burned off in just a few minutes and that the floors would not collapse and the steel temperatures were way too low had all been reported by the media or by government investigators. The only thing that may have been surprising about the letter I wrote was the information that UL should have already shared with all of us. The fact that they had tested the World Trade Center steel assemblies for fire resistance. But when my letter became public knowledge, UL acted very badly. They began by firing me. Then they stated that there was no evidence that any firm tested the steel used in the World Trade Center towers. They didn't say that their CEO was wrong or that they were in no way involved. They simply said there was no evidence. They have since used the shameful steel versus steel assemblies diversion as well. But now it's past time for us to get unambiguous answers from UL on this. We need them to speak plainly about their part in this issue that is so vital to our society, to the future of our society. The question is, was UL involved in any way in testing steel materials of any kind related to the construction of the World Trade Center towers? Did UL or did they not produce any relevant fire resistance data for the World Trade Center towers? If they did not produce such fire resistance data, why did their CEO write and speak for years as if they had done so without anyone correcting him? If they did produce such fire resistance data, why have they kept this information hidden from the public, and why have they lied to us about it? In the time since being fired for questioning the NIST report, I've had a chance to look at this report a little more closely. I had to wait for NIST to go from final draft to final report, and this took almost another year. When they did finally commit, however, they took great pains to avoid speaking to the issue of fire resistance testing of the steel component assemblies. Their report goes on for many pages about testing of the floor assemblies, but they effectively ignore the other half of the New York City Code requirement and the need for documentation to support it. When pressed, as in their June 2005 media presentation, they claim that those documents came up missing. In their investigation, NIST started with predetermined conclusions and then worked to support those conclusions by performing their tests in a deceptive manner. One example of the deception in their tests was something they called overventilation, or forcing oxygen into the workstation burn test environments in order to establish evidence for higher gas temperatures. Another example of deception was the application of at least twice the floor load known to have existed in the towers during the UL floor model tests. Despite these and other manipulations, the results of NIST's physical tests failed to support a fire-based theory of collapse. We can be certain that if it were possible to prove that those buildings collapsed from aircraft impact and the resulting fire, NIST would have found that proof and made it very clear to all of us. More importantly, there would not have been the need for several official investigations or for an ever-changing story. But although they could not establish this proof, this fact did not compel NIST to examine alternative, non-fire-based hypotheses for collapse. Instead, NIST created a computer model in which they first entered what they called realistic parameters and then replaced all these parameters with more severe parameters until they got a few computer responses that, as they said, compared to observed events. NIST's final computer-based collapse initiation sequence is completely false, as it either contradicts known facts about the buildings, is within itself inconsistent, and or it simply fails to present a realistic scenario. A number of people have taken the time to point out these facts, including myself, in an essay published on the online Journal of 9/11 Studies. You can get a lot more detail about the falsity of the NIST report there. By the way, note that if you buy the book, the paper by Stephen Jones is now located here as well, the Journal of 9/11Studies.com. He was recently forced to remove it from the Brigham Young University website. Therefore, it is not surprising that NIST has been so frequently receiving so many questions about their report. And it is not surprising that all these questions would lead most people to at least consider the one hypothesis NIST avoided at all costs, the demolition hypothesis. NIST has recently released a set of responses to frequently asked questions. One frequent question they're getting is simply this: why did NIST not consider a controlled demolition hypothesis? NIST's answer begins by following the lines of media descriptions of their report that usually begin and end with statements like structural engineers were involved or 10,000 pages NIST starts with much of the same superficial boasting by saying it was an extremely thorough 3-year investigation. And then they tell us of the number of experts involved and the number of documents reviewed and the people interviewed. But they don't answer the question. That's because the simple fact is, as can be seen from their archive presentations, NIST never considered the demolition hypothesis at all. They do go on to say now that, in retrospect, demolition is not a reasonable hypothesis because the collapse appeared to start from the top down, unlike conventional demolitions. But if objective scientists were to never consider a given hypothesis simply because there was no historical data to support it, scientific inquiry would have little meaning. On this question, NIST also states that they found no evidence for blasts or explosions below the collapse front. But this claim can be made only if one ignores a great deal of evidence, including numerous testimonies of eyewitnesses. And as any attorney can tell you, eyewitness testimony is most certainly evidence. Another of NIST's FAQs relates directly to evidence of explosions below the collapse front. This is the question of smoke and debris being ejected up to 30 floors below the collapse front in highly directed jets or bursts from the side of each building. NIST now calls these puffs of gas and says they were caused by the compression of air as the upper section of each building fell into the lower section. This explanation might be slightly believable if NIST had not finally forsaken the pancake theory in the same set of responses. It was Cheyenne Sunder of NIST who claimed in March 2005, even after the UL floor tests, that pancaking floors were to blame for those jets of debris. This is in the Popular Mechanics article, right? Pancaking floors. But NIST now openly admits that the floors could not have collapsed, and the pancake theory is officially, as well as experimentally, dead. So what caused the uniform compression of air without pancaking floors? An answer is difficult to imagine. How could air be compressed over a 4,000 square meter area and yet eject from only one small spot at a time on the side of a building as if from a cannon? For this to occur, the compression must have been laterally as well as vertically driven and contained at all spots other than the point of ejection. As with most of NIST's answers, this doesn't make much sense. I'll close out my comments by addressing one other question NIST is frequently getting. The question of UL's involvement in testing the World Trade Center steel assemblies. This question is critical now because NIST's latest study centers on the failure of these steel column assemblies. But unfortunately, NIST still bobs and weaves on this issue. Unlike FEMA, whose World Trade Center report clearly stated that UL's test data is the major reference used by architects and engineers to select designs that meet the building code requirements for fire resistance, NIST's answer to the UL question falls back again to the steel versus steel assemblies diversion and other semantic gains. They also misrepresent my statements by adding a new reference to 6 hours of testing, saying it is untrue the steel was tested for 6 hours. Despite this runaround, I would continue to press for an answer to this critical question. How does NIST know how long the tests might or might not have lasted if the documents came up missing? Did they interview Loring Knobloch or anyone else at UL? It seems we have a right to know. But as with the missing documents, there is no evidence that UL or NIST is interested in revealing the truth. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you very much. Perhaps you can answer this uncertainty that I have. Now, you were head of the water testing division.
That's right.
And yet this inquiry has to do with fire resistance. And perhaps this is a sign of my lack of knowledge in this area, but how were you able to apply your expertise to this particular set of circumstances?
That's a good question. A lot of people would have said, well, it should have been that chemist that ran the fire resistance, the fire testing division. It should have questioned these things. Tom Chapin. And I agree, it should have been him. Why wasn't it him? Well, maybe he was making too much money to do the right thing. Maybe he's afraid. A lot of people are afraid. And a lot of people say, well, we need answers from structural engineers. And if we were trying to reconstruct the buildings, that would be true. But we're trying to explain some very unusual evidence related to some very totally unprecedented events. That evidence includes a lot of matters of chemistry, and that's a good reason why there's a chemist running the fire protection division. Combustion reactions, for example, and molten pools of metal and phase changes of substances. Also, laboratory testing is what I was questioning, and I was a manager of a laboratory that did, although different types of samples, still testing the national standards. So, mainly my involvement in this had to do with information given to me. Very clear information that has since been denied, which makes my story a little bit bigger, unfortunately. But I think that I definitely have enough scientific background to question the evidence that's at hand.
Thank you. Let me ask you one more question. I imagine these shady computer models, as you describe them, and these sycophants, shady folks that see other priorities, must have you a little distressed. And I'm just interested from a human point of view. I imagine it's easier for you to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning. But how do you feel about losing your job over this? How do you feel about doing what you did?
I don't feel good about being fired, but I know I did the right thing, and I think for a lot of people, even today, they're thinking about this. They may have a little bit of knowledge of the puzzle, right? And they're thinking about, should I really put it all on the line? And all these professors are now under attack, right? The scholars for truth are under attack. The answer, I think, is to think of what I call enlightened self-interest, right? Going along to get along doesn't make a lot of sense if you see, as time goes on, that getting along is less and less plausible. Right? People are going to see this. There's no question. As time goes on, people are going to see that going along to get along is not a good idea. So hopefully I answered your question, Ray.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It is now my privilege to introduce to you someone that many of you know, Peter Dale Scott, co-editor of 9/11, American Interest. For those of you who don't know Peter, he is a professor emeritus of English at the University of California, Berkeley, former Canadian diplomat, and of course, co-editor of the volume which we celebrate this evening. Peter.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here. I want to talk tonight about using the 9/11 report as evidence of what is being suppressed. We can use it in this way because some parts of the report are accurate and reliable, and this baseline of reliability helps define other parts of the report which are misleading and in a few important places, I believe, dead wrong. These relevant omissions and deceptions should be taken as clues as to what is being suppressed and where the hidden truth lies. So I shall talk about the report's occasional resistance to the truth. Let me give an easy analogy from the Warren Report. The Warren Report got many things right, but it also minimized the links between Jack Ruby and organized crime. So for many of us, that was a clue that Ruby was in fact crime-related and that this was important. Now, the House Select Committee on Assassinations got many, many things wrong, but they amply confirmed the importance of Ruby's crime links. We find similar symptomatic resistance in the 9/11 report. Now, here's an easy example. The identity of the supposed hijackers. The FBI had distributed a list naming 18 of the 19 hijackers by 10 a.m. on September the 11th. This was before Flight 93 had hit the ground. Within 2 weeks, the identities of at least 6 of the hijackers were unclear, as men in Arab countries with the same names and histories, and in some cases the same photographs, were protesting that they were alive. In response to these protests, FBI Director Robert Mueller soon acknowledged that the identity of several of the suicide hijackers was in doubt. But there is no discussion of this problem in the detailed treatment of the alleged hijackers in the 9/11 Commission report. They just assume that the 19 were the ones identified at the beginning. Or take World Trade Center 7. Now, this is obviously a big area of doubt, as you've just heard. The report solution was just not to mention it at all. And yet, the two co-chairmen, Keene and Hamilton, in their new book, Without Precedent, have the nerve to claim in their book that after the report, and this is a quote, those believing conspiracy theories now had to rely solely on imagination, their theories having been disproved by fact. In other words, they're trying to cover up that there was a cover-up. And the third, which I'll talk about at length, is the U.S. government's intimate, ongoing connection to Al-Qaeda and a chief 9/11 plotter. In our book, which I edited with David Griffin, I wrote of Ali Mohammed, the close ally of Osama bin Laden and bin Laden's mentor, Ayman al-Zawahiri. It is now generally admitted that Ali Mohammed worked for the FBI, the CIA, and U.S. Special Forces. The 9/11 report mentioned him and said that the plotters against the U.S. Embassy in Kenya were led is their word, by Ali Mohammed. That's the report's only reference to him, though it's not all they heard. Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney who negotiated a plea bargain and confession from Ali Mohammed, said this in testimony to the commission. Ali Mohammed trained most of Al-Qaeda's top leadership, including bin Laden and Zawahiri, and most of Al-Qaeda's top trainers. He gave some training to persons who would later carry out the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. From 1994, he's right so far, but then he says, from 1994 until his arrest in 1998, he lived as an American citizen in California, applying for jobs as an FBI translator. Now, Patrick Fitzgerald knew Ali Mohammed well. In 1994, he had named him as an unindicted co-conspirator in the New York's Landmarks case, and yet he allowed him to remain free. This was because, as Fitzgerald knew, Ali Mohammed already was an FBI informant from at least 1993 and maybe 1989. Thus, from 1994 until his arrest in 1998, by which time the 9/11 plot was well underway, Mohammed shuttled between California, Afghanistan, Kenya, Somalia, and at least a dozen other countries. As I say in our book, in 1993, Ali Mohammed had been detained by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Canada in the company of an Al-Qaeda terrorist. Mohammed immediately told the RCMP to make a phone call to the United States, and this phone call secured his release. We've since been told that it was Mohammed's West Coast FBI handler, John Zent, who vouched for Ali and got him released. This enabled Ali to go on to Kenya, take pictures of the U.S. embassy, and personally deliver them to bin Laden for the embassy bombing plot. Now, a month ago, there was a National Geographic special on Ali Mohammed. We can take this as the new official fallback position on Ali Mohammed, because John Clunan, the FBI agent who worked with Fitzgerald on Mohammed, helped to narrate it. I didn't see the show, but here's what TV critics said about its contents. Ali Mohammed manipulated the FBI, CIA, and U.S. Army on behalf of Osama bin Laden. Mohammed trained terrorists how to hijack airliners, bomb buildings, and assassinate rivals. During much of this time, Mohammed was an operative for the CIA and FBI and a member of the U.S. Army. Mohammed turned up in FBI surveillance photos as early as 1989, trading radical Muslims who would go on to assassinate Jewish militant Meir Kahan and to detonate a truck bomb at the World Trade Center. He not only avoided arrest, but managed to become an FBI informant while writing most of the Al-Qaeda terrorist manual and helping plan attacks on American troops in Somalia and U.S. embassies, plural, in Africa. That Mohammed trained Al-Qaeda in hijacking planes and wrote the Al-Qaeda terrorist manual is now confirmed in a new book by Lawrence Wright, who has seen U.S. government records. Let me say this again. One of Al-Qaeda's top trainers in terrorism and how to hijack airplanes was an operative for the FBI, CIA, and the Army. Yet this TV show, just before the 9/11 anniversary, was itself another cover-up. It suppressed, for example, the information given it about Mohammed's detention and FBI-ordered release in Canada. According to Peter Lance, the principal author for the show suppressed many other sensational facts. Here is a key one, that Fitzgerald and his FBI counterpart on the bin Laden task force, John Clunan, learned shortly after 9/11 that Mohammed, and this is a quote, knew every twist and turn of the 9/11 plot. And here's a more quote from Lance. Within days of 9/11, Clunan rushed back from Yemen and interviewed Ali, whom the feds had allowed to slip into witness protection, and demanded to know the details of the plot. At that point, Ali wrote it all out, including details of how he'd counseled would-be hijackers on how to smuggle box cutters on board aircraft and where to sit to affect the airline seizures. Now, if these latest revelations about Ali and Mohammed are true, then, one, a key planner of the 9/11 plot and trainer in hijacking was an informant for the FBI. Two, this operative trained the members for all of the chief Islamist attacks inside the United States, the first World Trade Center bombing, the New York landmarks plot, and finally 9/11, as well as the attacks against Americans in Somalia and Kenya. And yet, for 4 years, Mohammed was allowed to move in and out of the country as an unindicted conspirator. And then, unlike his trainees, he was allowed to plea bargain. To this day, he may not yet have been sentenced for any crime. And he may, in fact, as two people have said, be in the witness protection program. Peter Lance's charge that Fitzgerald had evidence before 1998 to implicate Mohammed in the Kenya embassy bombing, yet did nothing and let the bombing happen. Did Fitzgerald have similar advance evidence before the 9/11 attack and again do nothing as well? Skeptics will need a lot of evidence to be reassured that this is not the case. As a first step, all U.S. agencies should release the full documentary record of their dealings with Ali Mohammed, who allegedly planned the details of the airline seizures. I hope you who are hearing this will insist on this. Then only a close interrogation of Fitzgerald will satisfy those who accuse members of the U.S. government of assisting the 9/11 plot, or alternatively, of failing to prevent 9/11 from happening. Now, what did the 9/11 Commission know about this scandalous situation? I suspect they knew more than they let on. Is it just a coincidence that they selected to write the staff report about the 9/11 plot and conduct the relevant interviews a man who had a stake in preventing the truth from Mohammed about Mohammed from coming out? This person was Dietrich Snell, who had been Fitzgerald's colleague in the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office, and his co-counsel in prosecuting Yamzi Yusuf in the Bojinka airline plot, which was a precursor for 9/11. And of the nine people on Snell's team writing this up for the public, all but one had worked for the U.S. government, and all but two had worked for either the Justice Department or the FBI. In other words, they were investigating themselves and writing a report which cleared themselves. Keep in mind that what I have said so far is about a government Mohammed connection and cover-up that goes back to at least 1990, long before the Bush-Cheney administrations. But the 9/11 Commission staff reports went out of their way to cover this up. The 9/11 report, based on these staff reports, mentions Mahmoud Abu Halima and Muhammad Asalame, two co-conspirators of Ramzi Yusuf in the first World Trade Center of 93. It does not mention that these two men had been trained by Ali Mohammed, even though Fitzgerald referred obliquely to this fact in his testimony. Nor does it mention that if it had not been for a police and FBI cover-up protecting Ali Mohammed back in 1990, Abu Halima and Salame should probably have been in jail at the time of the World Trade Center bombing for their involvement in the murder of Meir Kahan by Ali Mohammed's trainees 3 years earlier. Before leaving Mohammed, I want to say that in a day or two, I will have a footnoted text of this talk on my website at www.peterdalescott.net. I invite you to read it, and if you were persuaded by it, please exert pressure for full disclosure of the U.S. Ali Mohammed story. If I had had time today, I would have written about other key areas where the 9/11 report shows resistance to relevant facts and allegations. Central to these, and to my forthcoming book on 9/11, The Road to 9/11, would have been the report's failure to deal with important testimony challenging Vice President Cheney's account of his conduct on 9/11, and in particular, his important relationship, which the report obscured, to the stand-down and shoot-down orders of that day. There was important testimony contradicting both Cheney and the report itself, testimony from two eyewitnesses inside the White House, Norman Mineta and Richard Clark, which the report flagrantly and symptomatically failed to deal with. But I consider the scandal of Ali Mohammed's tolerated terrorism to be a still more fundamental problem, an ongoing problem for which we need a more serious remedy than just putting a Democrat in the White House. As as has happened after past intelligence fiascos, our intelligence agencies were strengthened as a result of the 9/11 Commission and their budgets increased. It's time to confront the reality that these agencies themselves and their own sponsorship and protection of terrorist activities have aggravated the greatest threats to our national security.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much. I can't help but think that when we reconstruct the Central Intelligence Agency, I hope that you will put your name in for Director of Analysis.
Well, thank you.
This was my bread and butter for 27 years, ferreting out the facts, connecting them, dots large and small. That's a tour de force, Peter, and I compliment you on your painstaking work. I think the average American would probably say, where'd you get all this stuff?
Well, thank God for the Internet. Actually, I wrote a good deal of my... I wasn't an Internet fan particularly until I went to Thailand. Some of you know I spent half of the years 2002 to 2005 in Thailand. And I couldn't take my whole library with me, so I had to go to the Internet. And then once I got the Internet habit and learned how to Google smartly, I found myself going rather rarely to the library except to corroborate what other people have claimed in books which I no longer believe. So all of you, any one of you in this room here, this huge hall, can do what I did. I had the advantage, I guess, that of having had 4 years in the service of the Canadian government, I learned in those 4 years not to trust governments. And that...
Thank you, Peter. Peter, one other question. One of the things most often adduced as the explanation for all this is gross incompetence, malfeasance, misfeasance. Some of my colleagues have said, well, you remember what it was like, Ray, working in the federal government. Just when you think they couldn't become any more incompetent, they make yet another egregious mistake. How do you feel about that? It seems to me what you've adduced here stretches credibility on that score, perhaps real close to it, beyond the breaking point.
Well, the fact that I'm certain of is that there has been a cover-up and it's ongoing. And the reality behind the cover-up, now I'm just speculating and I'm not on firm ground here. I think some of it is, it's not even so much incompetence, it's just the inability to organize a very large system like the American government. Why was Fitzgerald not putting Ali Mohammed away in jail? I suspect one reason was he wanted to, as he did, he used him as a witness in the Kenya bombing trial. And he might not have been able to put anybody in jail if he hadn't had the testimony of Ali Mohammed. So we have a lot of people focused on the wrong things and nobody focused on the right things. I think that explains a lot of it, but I also do not think it explains all of it because, as the Berkeley people here know, I've been looking at what the government does wrong ever since the beginning of the Vietnam War. And it's more, I think, it's more than just occasional incompetence here and there. They talk about the fog of war now. It was a factor on 9/11, I'm certain. It's not an adequate factor to explain what happened. And we have to find out what the truth was. That's my message. Thank you.
Now I'd like to ask you to welcome Peter Phillips, whom some of you know. Peter is professor of sociology at Sonoma State, and perhaps just as relevant, director of Project Censored.
On September 11th, 2001, a crime of great magnitude was perpetrated against the American people. The scope of that crime goes beyond the day itself. 9/11 became a justification for prolonged wars, suspension of habeas corpus, brutal torture, embedded media lies, governmental spying on Americans, and the first step in the realizations of the dreams of the neoconservative cadre of people who seek nothing less than the total military domination of the world. The 9/11 truth scholars challenged the fundamental roots of the neoconservative big lie by questioning the various aspects of the government's 9/11 report. The people in the 9/11 truth movement don't always agree on particulars, but the photos of the damage to the Pentagon on 9/11 seem to a reasonable person much smaller than a 757 airplane. The film of the collapse of Building 7 shows the failure in 6.6 seconds, free fall speed. Never has a steel frame building fell from fires alone, nor could fires simultaneously collapse all the 24 steel interior columns and bring the building down in its own footprint. Extensive pre-9/11 warnings, the put options, the money trail to ADA, Pentagon generals canceling their flights the day before, links to the Saudis, the quick exit of the bin Laden family members from the U.S., the 20-minute delay of Bush at the school in Florida, the immediate seeking of links to Iraq, the pre-planned invasion of Afghanistan, the prior histories of the alleged hijackers' links to U.S. intelligence agencies, and numerous other circumstantial questions led many of us early on to believe that the elements in the U.S. government, at a minimum, knew of the pending attack and either covered up the information or did nothing to prevent it. Now, as more information came forward, an increasing number of the people questioned the official government conspiracy theory, and now over 40% of the people in America doubt the veracity of the 9/11 Commission report. The corporate media government propaganda mill and the intelligence community psychological operations have gone on the offensive. They paint the 9/11 truth movement as kooks and paranoid conspiracy freaks. For example, the New York Times article covering the 9/11 truth conference in Chicago, they don't just ignore us anymore. I mean, they come and cover it. But last summer, it featured an activist who they said had spent 15 years of his life living in a cave. Now, I know this person. He's a wonderful videographer, and what living in a cave had anything to do with what he was doing there, and that it was clear from the editorial part of that they meant to discredit who we were. A Midwest English literature professor, Michael Sheldon, wrote in the Daily Telegraph last week, September 8th, that people who most likely believe in 9/11 conspiracies are those who regularly use the Internet, but do not regularly use mainstream media. So it's not difficult to find among the thousands of activists in the 9/11 truth movement those who have built conspiracy hypotheses beyond the available evidence. There's some there. And some do this professionally, like radio shock jocks on late night talk. And there's some of the hundreds of books published on 9/11 that make strange and outlandish claims linking secret societies and underground star chambers to 9/11. The people on this stage, and those we associate with, are not paranoid conspiracy nutcases, but the oppositional forces protecting the official 9/11 story like to link us with those that the public will see as delusional. In the Nation column, November 25th, Alexander Colburn calls David Ray Griffin the high priest of conspiracy nuts. Similarly, Math Rothschild at the Progressive, Harry Allen in these times, have dismissed the 9/11 truth scholars as unworthy of serious consideration. There's plenty. Now, I personally know each of these writers, and I have a great respect for a lot of their work, but I strongly believe that the truth of 9/11 is vital to the future of the U.S. It's vital to the future of the world. And questions on 9/11 must not be dismissed. We need an independent commission with subpoena power, a multi-million dollar budget to openly investigate the unanswered questions and the contradictions of 9/11. Those who had the means, the motive, and the opportunity to perpetuate this crime, we've got some good suspects, and we need to be able to ask them the question. And it may take, impeaching the president movement with half the people in the country support. To open up hearings where we can ask these questions. Yes, and did you notice how the Chronicle had those three pictures of Chavez on the front page, and they looked like they had reddened his face, to make him look really evil, and they were from different sources, so it was a deliberate, trying to make him look kind of crazy. At Project Center, we move really slowly and carefully about these kinds of issues. And I originally saw 9/11 as kind of a blowback situation with, our involvement with the Afghans and the Mujahideen in the Russian war in Afghanistan. But after researching all the 9/11 warnings, I began to suspect early on that the government certainly let it happen to facilitate a global war and expanded military spending. The passage of the Patriot Act, the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, expanded military budgets were all part of the plan of these neoconservatives for global military dominance. I now tend to suspect that a small group of operatives within the U.S., either from private sources or government agencies, helped facilitate 9/11 5 years ago. Now, it was David Ray Griffin's work. In particular, with Stephen Jones and the hypotheses that the demolitions were the most likely reason for the World Trade Center to have collapsed. They were key reasons for me changing my position. But also a year ago, the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings about Able Danger, which described how in 1999 and 2000, a team of U.S. Army intelligence specialists working in cooperation with Orion Scientific Systems identified Mohammed Atta and three of the other alleged terror suspects at the center of a Brooklyn al-Qaeda cell. The Able Danger team under U.S. Special Operations Command had been conducting data mining on people believed in al-Qaeda. Now, data mining is the computer processing of vast amounts of information and communications, kind of like what NSA is doing on all now, focusing in this case on known members of al-Qaeda. So during the operations, Able Danger team was able to map al-Qaeda worldwide with a surprising presence in the U.S. On three occasions, the Able Danger team attempted to go to the FBI with the data that they had and were ordered by the Pentagon officials to stand down. They even built a chart with Mohammed Atta in the center, interlinked with not only the other alleged, but everybody else they had talked to in the United States. So, U.S. residents, U.S. citizens, they put a chart together, they took it to the White House, the charts disappeared, and they were ordered in 2000 to destroy all of their evidence and to stand down. They got different assignments. Now, U.S. Army Major Eric Kleinsmith was able to testify, he no longer is in the military. The Pentagon refused to allow the other members of the team who were still on active duty to testify. And just this past week, it was the anniversary of those hearings, the Pentagon said that they didn't remember right in their reports and when they were asked again about Able Danger. So the fact is that a high-level U.S. military public-private partnership with defense contractor and intelligence uncovered U.S. links, U.S. citizen links, to the suspects, terror suspects, prior to 9/11. And then all of this information was officially destroyed under direct orders from the Pentagon. Now, it's clear from the hearings that some of that data may still exist. So we really don't know who inside the United States helped facilitate these events on 9/11. Our research at Project Censored, however, we kept hearing they did this, they did that, and we wanted to put some parameters on they. So two researchers, Celeste Bolger and Bridget Thornton, were heavily involved a year ago last summer, and we built a network analysis, standard sociological practice, network analysis, where we look at key people in various groups, the defense contractors, the neoconservative think tanks, the Project for New American Century, and we identified 237 people, very core people who are the advocates for the U.S. military domination of the world. This includes the 25 founders of the Project for New American Century in 1997. This was funded by the American Enterprise Institute, same people that came out of the Reagan and Bush the First administrations. And they were advocates for the U.S.-led New World Order. And their 97 statement of principles set forth their aims as the need to increase defense spending, carry out our global responsibilities, and modernize our armed forces for the future, challenge hostile regimes. They specifically identified Iran, Iraq, China, and North Korea, and promote the cause of political and economic freedom abroad, freedom for our corporations to do business around the world, and a role in preserving and extending the international order friendly to our security, our prosperity, and our principles. Now, these are public documents, so that they're right out there. Now, this was signed by Elliot Abrams, William Bennett, Jeb Bush, Richard Cheney, Elliot Cohen, Steve Forbes, Donald Kagan, Zame Khalizad, Louis Libby, Dan Quayle, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and 13 others. Now, those 25 founders of PNAC, 12 of them went on to have high-level positions in George W. Bush's administration. So the philosophy, this neoconservative philosophy of global domination, is deeply embedded in the United States government today. Now, 3 years later, they build this document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's published in 2000. It calls for homeland protection, simultaneous theater wars worldwide, global police role, the control of space and weapons in space, the control of the internet and cyberspace, and they want to have a Pax Americana and control all rivals. China, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, they all have to be kept in check. And this is the report, which many people know, but it said the process of transformation is likely to be long. And they were, you know, the American people aren't going to just go for this global domination idea with military bases all over the world and pay for this whole thing unless there is a catastrophic, catalyzing event such as a new Pearl Harbor. Now, that was less than a year and a half before 9/11 that they wrote that. So, this was 9/11 was exactly the event that they wanted to accelerate this global dominance agenda. And this led many of us to think that the advocates for total military domination of the world through a forced Pax Americana should be considered principal suspects in 9/11. The boards of directors of the top military defense contractors, those who've made the big profits, Lockheed Martin stock increased 300%, Northrop Grumman the same thing, Carlyle Group, they sold United Technologies, made $1 billion, Halliburton 2,000% increase in their stock values. So this is a good list of suspects. And those associated with the key global dominance group, like American Enterprise, the Hoover Institute, the Heritage Foundation, they should be questioned about their knowledge of pre-knowledge of 9/11, their pre-knowledge of the specific suspects of what happened and what they knew. So a new investigation's necessary. And, you know, they call us nutcases. I'm going to conclude by reading a quote from John Pilger. He wrote this about Richard Perle. I interviewed Richard Perle when he was advising Reagan, and he spoke about total war. I mistakenly dismissed him as mad. He recently used the term again in describing America's war on terror. No stages. This is total war. We're fighting a variety of enemies. Lots of them out there. All this talk about first we're going to do Afghanistan, then we'll do Iraq, is entirely the wrong way to go about it. If we just had our vision of the world go forth, we embrace it entirely, we don't try to piece together clever diplomacy, we just wage total war. Our children will sing great songs about us years from now. Now, Cheney, just at the AIPAC hearings in March, he's talking about how the terrorists now are all over the world. They want to build a totalitarian empire stretching from southern Spain to Indonesia. So we got to have bases everywhere to fight them all over the world. So we asked for independent media to take up the challenge of exploring the principal questions around 9/11, not join in the corporate media's automatically dismissing the scholars. And this assembly tonight from KPFA is a wonderful addition to that. And the reporter's there. And it hasn't been easy. There's been infighting about this. And we have to make sure that we can't just dismiss the scholars, dismiss serious, legitimate academic research. It's far too serious of an issue. We can't stop until we know the answers. The future of democracy, freedom, human rights depend on our action. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much indeed. I'm just wondering if we're not beginning to see some movement, even in the corporate media. Maybe this is wishful thinking, but the lies have been so blatant, so numerous, and so consistent that when I see people like Keith Olbermann speaking out about things... You know, when I had my four-minute conversation with Rumsfeld, the Fox News dismissed me as a heckler, an alleged former CIA analyst. And when I got home, my wife said, are you going to come clean with me now? Was CIA just a cover? But I do see some hopeful signs of change. I mean, maybe it's become too much even for these birds. Do you see any of that?
Well, I see that like the Washington Post is attacking David and Stephen, on the inside pages.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing it in London. We're seeing it in other places around. Chronicle had some stories about 9/11 that were semi-objective. So we're starting to see some of that, and that these kinds of gatherings and the Zogby polls that were 40% now, the country doubting the truth, is starting to come forward. Now they'll keep trying to link us with some of the crazy theories and dismiss us, but as we pull these kind of events together, and as we do the kinds of research that our book that we collectively put together has done, it seems that we're on that direction. So, you know, at first they ignore you, then they attack you, and then you win.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen. And if I would just say, Peter, that that's what we're all about this evening, and that's what you all have been all about for the last several years. And I think we are making some progress, and I think that we need not be disheartened when we see the American people coming around slowly, but surely. I think when you're engrossed in this, it's really hard to see slow movement, but I see it, and I'm very encouraged with it, and I compliment you all for being responsible for it. Just to finish up here, I was thinking as I was listening to everyone, it's so obvious
the reason there are unanswered questions is because the U.S. government will not answer the questions. They know the answers to the questions, and so it's really ridiculous for them to be accusing others of being conspiracy theorists when they won't answer the questions. Fairly obvious. Now, we've been working with heavy stuff here. And one of the things we try to do in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity is to keep our sanity. And sometimes we resort to what others might think are frivolous. But I would like to tell you a story about faith-based intelligence. You see, in Washington, we do a lot of faith-based things. And with the advent of this administration, we extended that to faith-based intelligence. And to give you an idea of what that's all about, I have to tell the story from my Irish heritage of these two nuns in Northern Ireland. They're going home from the hospital where they worked, and they don't get run out of petrol at 4 o'clock in the evening, and it's getting dark. They look under the bonnet, and they look in the trunk, and they have no gas can, but they do have a bedpan from the hospital. So they take that down to the petrol station, and struggling with it back. One nun opens the gas can, and the other one's struggling with the bedpan, and they're struggling both, and all of a sudden, a limousine pulls up. Fancy one with one of those buttons that the window goes right down in. And who's there but the Reverend Ian Paisley? And he looks at the nuns, and he says, "Sisters, I don't agree with your religion, but I do admire your faith." Now, faith-based intelligence and faith-based explanations of the kind we've heard from our government are worth exactly what Ian Paisley thought was in that bedpan. Now, on a more serious note, Richard Clark wrote a book which he called Against All Enemies. Who knows what that phraseology comes from? Please. Foreign and domestic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did this advisedly. It comes from the oath. And I was out at Annapolis earlier this week talking to two large groups of mids, they call them, midshipmen. And they were not really familiar with the oath that they had sworn as they came in as midshipmen. And so we had to recount it. To defend and protect the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, we haven't devoted specific attention to domestic enemies here, although it's implicit in much of what we're saying. But when Richard Clark recounts the evening of 9/12, when he comes out of the Situation Room and sees the President wandering around alone, President bringing Richard Clark and some of his associates in a side room and saying, "Was it Bin Laden? Was it Iraq? Was it Iraq?" I'm sorry, he said, "Was it Iraq?" And Richard Clark said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, I told you yesterday, it was Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda doesn't have anything to do with Iraq." And the President said, "Well, you look into that. You make sure you look at every scrap. I know you're busy right now, but as soon as you can get to it, make sure you see if there's any content, if there's any connection between what happened here in Iraq." And it was so patently obvious what was going on that one of Clark's associates, when she walked into the room, she saw the mouths agape and said, what happened? And another one of Clark's associates said, "Wolfowitz got to him." Now, that is the serious question, and that is what happened and was enabled. And the skids were greased, actually, by this terrible event. And that's all the more reason, with 3,000 of our own soldiers dead, we have to get to the bottom of what happened. And so I just want to thank everyone here who is so assiduously working on this kind of thing. And I think we're about to have some questions from the audience. Is that correct? So please hang tough. We're going to be right back.
I put him in his
seat. Get to the balcony. Don't forget us.
Okay. We can't see you up there, but it's good to know you're there.
I put them in some sort of order.
Okay. First question is, do any panel members have an opinion regarding the legality of American-Israeli dual citizenship for highly placed individuals within the Defense Department? Who would like to entertain that? Peter, would you try that one?
I don't know. I don't have anything really important to add to this, except that one of the PNAC members has a law firm in Jerusalem, and his partner is very active on behalf of West Bank settlers. I don't think that I would want to make a blanket statement. Well, unfortunately, I don't have my notes here, and I'm an old man. It's Faith or Libby. Is it Faith? Yeah, it's Doug Faith then. I wouldn't want to make a blanket prohibition on people. There are a lot of dual nationals in this country. But I think proper vetting for a post in the U.S. government should have found something very odd in that particular liaison.
Mm-hmm. What about secret detention camps being set up by FEMA?
Well, it was just one of our stories in the Censored book this year about Halliburton receiving the contract to build expanded detention camps all over the country. There's nothing secret about it. It just hasn't been in the papers. I mean, we know about it.
In my book, I'll be talking about...
Just speak right into it, please.
In my book, I'll be talking about what one of the neglected aspects of what happened on September 11th was the institution of COG. How many people know what COG is? It's supposed to stand for continuity of government, but I think it really, you should think of it as standing for change of government. It's what Oliver North was working on in 1984 and led to the famous question from Congressman Jack Brooks in the Iran-Contra hearings. Is it true, Mr. North, Colonel North, that you've been working on a plan to suspend the American Constitution? And Senator Inouye, who was a Democrat, hammered his gavel and said, we cannot go into that in the public session. The answer was, yes, he was. And what has only come out recently is that there was a special group who continued to plan this even after North left the government. And one of the members of that very small group was then-Congressman Cheney, and another one was Donald Rumsfeld, who at the time was the chief executive officer of a drug company. And yet he was working on plans to suspend the American Constitution and institute a shadow government, use the caves that had been dug into mountains all around Washington. And on that day, something like 100 officials went off to these to create a kind of second government. You had Wolfowitz in the cave, you had Rumsfeld in the Pentagon. Theoretically, if there was really COG, Wolfowitz should have been the man in charge. Well, at that time, one of the things that was done, they inaugurated what became a plan in the future Department of Homeland Security, a 10-year plan to build detention centers. Now, they say the purpose of the detention centers is to handle illegal immigrants in this country. There are 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, so that's not a very reassuring statement. But North was planning the same thing back then, and they were always talking about a wave of migration coming over from Mexico, but they've always said, and it's in the Halliburton contract, that it can be for other situations that may arise. So I don't want to get too paranoid about this, but I think it tells you something about the mindset of these people who are planning COG. that they are planning operations to defend themselves, in effect, from the American people.
Here's the next question. Do you have a working model of how to deal with the sociological and psychological resistance people have to thinking critically about this information? Mindset, denial, patriotism.
It was about 2 years ago, and this Thursday morning men group of sociologists, psychologists that I go to every week, and we were trying to figure out, well, what can we call this if people just won't refuse to address things like the truth of 9/11 or the voter fraud in 2004. And my good friend Noel Byrne, who's sociologist, said, well, it's kind of like a threshold concept. I mean, you got to cross that threshold and go into that scary closet. So we put a name on it, and there really is a psychological barrier for people because, you know, it's terribly fearful to think that someone in our government would perpetrate a crime of this magnitude. And yet we can think of other people out there that would be so evil that they would do that, but we can't think of that about ourselves.
And
remember Gladio, exactly, and the book quite well covers the history of our involvement in doing this and all the false flag operations the United States has been involved in and other Western democracies. And Gladio was certainly one with the left behind organizations in various countries in Europe that were organized by the CIA, and then the bombings that were done in Italy, then blamed on the communists. So we've seen a lot of that historically. Operation Northwoods is talked about in our book and very part of that, which David knows a lot about.
David.
Yes, let me just add a note that we have two essays in this book about this. Daniel Gonser, of course, has written a whole book about NATO secret armies and giving a special attention to Operation Gladio in Italy, and also Ola Tunander, his essay deals more generally with this. So this is very important. I'm increasingly aware how there are two Americas on this issue, of people who are tuned in and know what's going on, at least strongly suspect that 9/11 is an inside job, and the rest of America, which is a shrinking number, but still don't have a clue, or if they hear the idea, it's just beyond their conception.
How many people would have to be involved in a cover-up and conspiracy? Assuming it would be a large number, how can they all be kept silent? Does the lack of insiders coming forward suggest that there may not have been a conspiracy?
This is one of the two most popular questions asked all the time. And no, it is not surprising, because in the first place, an operation like this, you have a very small core group who know the whole plan. And these are people who are tried and tested. They know how to keep their mouth shut. Furthermore, why would any of them talk and risk the gas chamber? This would be guilty. They'd be guilty of treason, mass murder, all this. These people are not going to talk. Now, what about other people, the next ring around, who were not in on the planning but realized in retrospect that they participated in this operation? It doesn't take much to discourage someone from going forward, particularly when nobody is asking them to come forward. The 9/11 Commission certainly did not plead with the American people and say, please, if you know something about this, come and testify. The news media, if anybody does speak out, they're ridiculed as conspiracy theorists. If anybody who's a politician gives even a hint that they thought it was an inside job or that it was advanced knowledge, their career is ruined. If this doesn't discourage people, all it takes is something, you know, you say, well, Joe, I know you're thinking of going to the press, but if you do, I don't know who's going to protect your wife and kids. Is Joe going to go forward? I don't think so. Now, a few Joes might, and there has been just recently. I don't want to go into details because we haven't had a chance to check out the authenticity of this. But it may be that in just the last few days, a whistleblower with actual inside knowledge of Standdown has come forward. So there may be an answer pretty soon to this question. And once this happens, many more may come forward. So anybody who's thinking of coming forward, let me give the example of Kevin Ryan, who's a much happier man today than if he hadn't come forward.
Thank you, David. When you talk about Joe coming forward or not coming forward, of course, we did have Joe Wilson coming forward with an extreme act of courage. And, of course, the reporters were told that wives are fair game in that respect, and, of course, that's what happened. So there are disincentives, but there are also great incentives. And I dare say, with this question receiving the kind of attention that it is, it should be easier for people to come forward. Have mainstream media challenged or discredited the evidence that suggests WT7, Building 7, was felled by explosives, or has this demolition notion not even been addressed in the mainstream media?
Well, I'll try to speak to that. I'm not an expert on World Trade Center 7, but I am gaining knowledge fairly quickly. The mainstream media generally doesn't talk about World Trade Center 7. You don't see the collapse on television. In fact, I've been told by some that there are policies at major media networks that we don't show buildings collapsing on television recently for some reason. The interesting thing about World Trade Center 7 is that 8 months after the 9/11, the Federal Emergency Management Administration put out a report, and obviously they'd worked pretty hard at determining what they could about what happened, and they came up with the pancake theory for the towers. They couldn't come up with anything for World Trade Center 7 at all, really, and other than the fact that they were clear that the building collapsed solely because of fire and not because of any damage done from the collapse of the Twin Towers. And from comments made by NIST recently, it's clear that NIST is going to try and bob and weave a little bit more and contradict that statement by coming up with some sort of story of damage to Building 7 from the towers. So no, I would say that the media is not addressing World Trade Center 7, or they're trying not to as much as possible.
Thank you, Kevin. Peter?
I just want to add that on that terrible internet you've heard so many bad things about, you can actually hear and see Dan Rather on the evening of 9/11 showing a picture of World Trade Center going down, and he says something like, there, right before our eyes, we are seeing the controlled demolition of this building. Just as NBC that morning, now here you don't hear it, but there are transcripts, and I believe the transcripts, were talking candidly about the explosions that were heard in the building before the building went down. Of course, that all disappeared very quickly, but very often, the first evidence often will tell you things that you don't get later on. And I could give many examples of that in 9/11.
One further factor about this is the strange behavior of NIST, N-I-S-T. They have delayed their report on Building 7. So the 9/11 Commission doesn't even mention Building 7. NIST has not given a report yet, says it won't do it until after the next election. If you go on a website called the Muckraker Report, which is run by Ed Haas, you will find a discussion between him and Michael Newman, who is the spokesperson for NIST. And Haas said, you know, we've got all these people, these scientists like Jones and Hoffman and others, who reject your report, why don't we just have a public national debate on television between your scientists and the scientists from the 9/11 Truth Movement, and if you're confident, you should just be able to demolish them. And Newman said, no NIST scientist will participate in any public debate.
Next question, and I am told we'll only have three more. How did Flight 77, or whatever struck the Pentagon, get past the batteries of ground-to-air missiles? Was there a code declaring friend or foe that was necessary?
This is something that many of us are very convinced of, that is, that there were surface-to-air missiles protecting the Pentagon. Many people who have visited the Pentagon or had parents who worked at the Pentagon have said that definitely there were such missiles protecting the Pentagon. And it makes sense. Surely the Pentagon is the most protected building in the world. And when the president went to Genoa, why they put up missiles on his hotel. So surely the Pentagon would be protected. And so even if one believes that what hit the Pentagon was a commercial airplane, it still had to be an inside job because somebody in the Pentagon had to turn off those automatic batteries of missiles.
Does this have anything to do with Secretary Mineta witnessing this young man, undescribed, coming in and asking Dick Cheney, same orders, it's only 50 miles out, it's only 30 miles out, quite close now, same orders, and a few seconds later, whatever hit the Pentagon hits it. Does that have anything to do with this?
Well, they're related in that they both expose the falsity of the official theory, but I wouldn't say these are the same thing, but this story is so important. And by the way, the story that appeared in the Washington Post by Michael Powell was a breakthrough because it was the first time any mainstream journalist reported this contradiction between when the 9/11 Commission said Cheney went down to the underground bunker, that is almost 10 o'clock, 9:58 they assumed, whereas Mineta had testified that when he got down there at 9:20, Cheney was already there. So you have at least a 40 minute lie there. And so Michael Powell made a great breakthrough first reporting contradiction in the 9/11 Commission report.
If a missile hit the Pentagon, what happened to the plane and the passengers on that flight?
This is the other most popular question that's asked. And, there are hundreds of things that could have happened to this other plane. So to believe that what hit the Pentagon was not Flight 77, we don't have to have a theory. We don't have to have knowledge of what happened to Flight 77. There are dozens of things that could have happened to it. The 9/11 Commission only had an $11 million budget, but that's far more than I have to work on this. And I can't subpoena anybody. So all the things, in other words, what we need is a genuine investigation. I would love to know what happened to Flight 77 and Barbara Olson, but until we have a genuine investigation, we probably won't.
Thank you. I have two questions related to the same thing, and it's Iran rather than Iraq. And is Dan Ellsberg here by any chance, my good friend Dan? Okay, one of the questions has to do with the article that Dan has in the current issue of Harper's, which is a very significant article, and which I would urge you all to get a hold of. It has to do with whistleblowing. The question here has to do with how that might relate to encouraging people who know about Iran war planning to come out and speak out. And not wait until the war starts and then write a book about it, which happens all too often.
Now, the other question is, will Bush attack Iran? When, how, on what grounds? Who will resist? Military factions, CIA diplomats, retired U.S. politicians? Well, most of my colleagues in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity do believe that the preparations are pretty much in place to attack Iran. Most of my colleagues believe this will come after the election. I'm in a small minority that believes they will come in the next 7 weeks. Why? Because the president's numbers are way down, and the stakes are very high. If the Democrats take the House, despite what Nancy, our friend Pelosi, has said, well, we can't possibly impeach this fellow no matter what he's done, you can bet your bottom dollar John Conyers will be there in a week impeaching this guy. Not only that, every other committee of this Congress would be headed by a Democrat who would be pursuing the abuses and the violations of law that happened over the last 6 years. Now, that's a dim prospect for the president to look at. Not only that, but after 2 years, the president himself will be liable for prosecution under the U.S. War Crimes Act, passed by Newt Gingrich's Congress in 1996. So, my friend, the stakes could not be higher, and I can see Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and Rumsfeld and the president sitting around the table and saying, "What are we going to do? This is serious. Look, you're down in the 30s. We need something to be able to go to the American public and say, look, the president's a war president. It's a wider war now. And the last thing he needs is for you to pull the rug out from under him by electing a bunch of wusses into the Congress, these Democrats who won't support the war on terror, okay?" And so I can see where I would not put it past this crowd to make a decision to go after Iran using Israel this time more than Israel using us, and saying our ally Israel is directly threatened by Iran. But we all know, of course, that Israel is our ally, right? No, I'm serious. How many don't know that? There is no alliance with the State of Israel. There is no defense treaty that would permit the president to say accurately that Israel is our ally. And I always thought that the reason for that was that the United States was being prudent for once and didn't want to tick off the Arabs still more than already has, and didn't want to become automatically involved in hostilities in the Middle East. But that wasn't the answer, folks. Do you know why there's no defense treaty with Israel? We offered them one. We offered them one in 1967 after the war. We thought it might be a good idea to restrain everybody there, and the Israeli government said, I really appreciate the thought, but thanks, but no thanks. Why? Because international treaties require internationally recognized boundaries, and the Israelis had just taken over the West Bank and Gaza, and didn't want to hear anything about international boundaries, nor did they want to be having to tell the United States if they prepare to take off after some other country like Lebanon or Syria or something like that. And so that's the reason there is no war. And so you're sitting in Tel Aviv now, and you're sitting pretty, aren't you? You're saying, oh, gosh, we have no obligations to the United States, but here's the President of the United States referring to us consistently as his ally, and referring to the alliance in quotes, and pledging to come to our defense if we're threatened by anyone. And so that will be the rationale, folks. We will be hearing that Israel is deathly threatened by Iran, and that Iran is fooling around with Hezbollah and causing all problems in Lebanon. It's preparing IEDs in the southern part of Iraq, and we have to do something about that sooner or later. Remember where you heard it first. I see that coming before the election, just to get the president's numbers up. I think that's all the time we have for questions, but until somebody gives me the hook, I'm going to ask another one. There is already a 9/11 official report. What could possibly compel another official investigation? How could its independence be assured, given the corruption and cover-up of the first one?
Uh,
I was recently in Europe and spoke in four cities and made the point that we in the movement in this country still hold out hope that there may be a genuine, independent investigation in this country, but that that is really not very likely. So I called on the Europeans to establish a commission to look into this. And there are other parts of the world that might do this as well. So so we may get an investigation. Of course, whether the mainstream media in this country will report it is another question.
I just add that I think what we really need urgently right now is evidence. That the 9/11 report is in some ways like the Warren report, but at least the Warren Commission had the decency to publish their evidence. So the 9/11 Commission decided, or they say they reached an agreement, is what Keene and Hamilton say, to release their evidence on January the 9th, 2009. Well, to talk simultaneously, as they do all through their book, about how we decided to go for transparency and openness, and then hold back the evidence, there's obviously a disconnect there. I don't see much point in having a commission in Venezuela or in Sweden that can't get to the evidence. The evidence is there. You can define areas which were never seen by the 9/11 Commission, like Secret Service, they saw some Secret Service logs, but tapes, they did not see. The White House Communications Agency tapes, they did not see. That's one reason to elect Democrats is to get committees that will call for that evidence and let us, we may not be brilliant, but we can do as good a job as the 9/11 Commission did.
talk about damning with faint praise. how can you prove a physics teacher wrong when he claims that the two towers collapsed because of a seismic shock wave or a fault in their construction? Where can you find information to disprove the official story?
Well, I haven't seen a theory so far saying that the buildings collapsed from a seismic shock. There is a paper at the 9/11, at the Journal of 9/11Studies.com, regarding the seismic recordings and their relation to the impact times of the aircraft. So how can you prove, the question is, how can you prove an independent researcher's theory false? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, you'd have to have that theory, and that's closely related to the entire progress of the NIST investigation. They took years before they actually committed to saying something. So it took us that long before we could start analyzing what they actually said. So first of all, whatever it is has to be published somewhere. And then we can all take a look at it closely. And I think seismic recordings are good evidence and worthy of investigation.
I could add a word. This is a phenomenon that I've noticed is very widespread, that people will grasp at any explanation that protects the official theory if they want to believe it. So maybe this physics teacher realized fire could not have brought the buildings down. So therefore he said it must have been a seismic shock. Time magazine this last week came out with this rather remarkable story. They cited a lot of facts from that were reported in the Loose Change. But then, rather than refuting any of those facts, the author just gave a psychological refutation, saying, well, there are people who just need to believe these things. There are people who need to believe that some big force, some big conspiracy handled this. Well, sure, there are such people, but there's a much more powerful motive, the motive of people to believe that their government would not do such a thing and this phenomenon shows this, they will grasp at almost anything that will save the appearance of innocence of their own government.
Thank you. We do need to close now. Let me just say that we here are privileged because we look out on a sea of educated, determined, committed people who are going to change all this. And you don't see much of that back in the East Coast where I come from. And so I applaud you for being here. I would remind you that we still can congregate, we can still, you know, freely assemble, but if we want to protect that, we need to get off our rear ends and do something for the next 7 weeks to make sure that it comes out all right in November. Thank you very much.
Panelists featured in this event contributed to the book 9/11 and American Empire. For more information on the ideas discussed in this program, visit 911truth.org.